That's right. Better up front. No, come on. Yes, that would be nice. Just then we have your email and everything. I mean, not that we don't, but... Come on in, everyone. That's right. We're going to try to have time for questions, so I'm going to try to start a little bit early, although I can't promise anything. I'm always attempting to have time for questions, which shows you how. But there you go. Hey, brother. Good to see you. I highly recommend cruising as a form of vacation for anyone that's interested. It's a great, particularly when your parents pay for it. That's the best. So, come on in, everyone. You can just leave that door open in case people come. But I thought we would go ahead and start because there's a lot of information. People coming. So let's pray. The Lord be with you. Lord Jesus, we thank you for your life for the world. We pray that you would be with our, be in us, with us, and for us today, as always. In your name we pray. Amen. Well, good morning. The thinking behind the past 4 weeks, or the past 2 weeks, and then this week and the next week, is the four reasons people don't come to church. Now, of course, there are many more than four, but these were kind of the great themes. So if you've missed the past 2 weeks, as I have also, the recap of that is that, Robin, one of the excuses that people have is that Sunday is my only day to go to church, only day to sleep. And so Robin talked about, time management and priorities, and, I think the end point of that is that people make time for things that they not just want to do, but particularly things they have to do. I have to go get my hair cut this week, and I don't want to do it, but I'm going anyway. And so there's a sense in which the church as an optional something involved in people's lives says something both about the people that claim that, but also about the church that they're attending. Because church is nothing if it's not something that should demand, at the very least, your attention. Now, whether you ignore it or not is one thing, but demanding the claims and the ideas that we talk about at church should be things that actually force you to at least take account of them. And the sad part about a lot of what happens in church is that most people believe that they already basically know what they're going to hear. If you're a man, you're going to hear that you don't come to church enough and that you need to be more like, your wife or something, who's like kinder than you are and gentler than you are, and you need to stop scratching. This is basically what men think church is about. And women actually perpetuate this by dragging their husbands to church so that they can get some sense talked into them. That's what, and so I don't blame a lot of men for not coming to church. And I don't blame, on the other side, because there's this, such an allure to going to watch football and play golf on Sunday mornings, the inevitable fights that ensue, well, it's just not worth it for most wives to deal with. And even they probably are like, well, I'm only really going so he'll be a little bit more like Jesus, who, as we all know, was basically like my best hairdresser friend, who like listens to me and cries on my shoulder and, is like really the type guy I want my husband to be, like Jesus, And so it's all such a terrible mess that I'm surprised where any of us are here this morning. So that's one of the reasons. And then last week, Robin, we talked about money, about how all the church wants is your money. Well, things need money to run. But we all give money to things that we like to see running. And so people reluctantly give money to church because they someday want to get married, or at least they want their daughter to have a church wedding, so they hope the building's still there or something. But most people, what you can see what's happening here is that I'm not very sympathetic to excuses why people don't go to church when they're based upon this implied idea that if it were only otherwise, I would go. Because people go to church when they have to go to church. People go to church because they need to hear the gospel. And so people go to churches where the preaching is terrible, where the heaters don't work, where there's like one old lady on an organ that's out of tune, and yet they go. People go to church, in the middle of the desert. People go to church, more people go to church in China where it's illegal than all of the UK combined. I mean, people go to church. And so the fact that you don't go, or your friends don't go, or your children don't want to go, well, I'm not very sympathetic to the reasons why, but I am very interested in the fundamental, the specific reasons why. But I am very interested in the general reason why, which is that they don't actually believe in what the church is talking about. I mean, that's what it is. Like, if you're not going to find another building that talks about Jesus and his life for you other than a church. I mean, you can read a book about it. You can sort of meditate on it yourself. But if you, and you'll hear about this in the sermon or you just heard about it, if you need to, the way that our lives and bodies and hearts and minds are set up is that we can't engender this faith on our own. We can't spark our own souls. We can't baptize ourselves. We can't give ourselves communion. It must be done for us, to us, and outside of us. So we come to church because that's where we can sit and be reminded and hear once again that despite your fears, despite your anxiety that woke you up at 2 o'clock in the morning, despite the cancer scare that you just went through, despite the diagnosis you just got, God has not remained silent, has not left you, and is still in your life and in the world. And so people that talk to me all the time, well, you know, if the church were only at 3:48 in the afternoon, I would come. I'm like, well, you know, I mean, what else, what's at 3:45? Well, I couldn't miss this, you know, I couldn't miss that, or I couldn't, well, it's like, well, you know, I'm, that's fine. But someday, if you're like me, if you're like millions of people around the world, then your life is actually begins with where church is. And then from that, the rest of your life is ordered. And the fact that people aren't there, well, that's what we're addressing, because that's what I'm involved in. Because, you know, like I tell people all the time, I mean, this church is like a cruise ship. I mean, it really is. Like, you know, if you like liturgical worship and you don't like this church, well, then you might need to question whether you're a Christian, because like this, I mean, this is like the Bentleys of churches. It's, you know, so if you don't like this church, you don't like cars, you know, like, you know, if you don't like a Bentley or a Vermeer, I mean, a Veyron, really, but if you, you don't, you know, then there's something wrong with you. So, you know, yeah. So anyway, all that being said, good, we're right on time. That was supposed to just be a little welcome. So I'm basing this this talk on three books that I highly recommend you get, and if you want them, just email me, and we're going to go back to them in the beginning. But the one on the left is called Unchristian, and it's a reflection by a bunch of different theologians and very different pastors and from all sorts of different churches. I mean, people from like Chuck Colson to, well, the late Chuck Colson to big Baptist churches, Presbyterian, Episcopal, it doesn't matter. The point is, it's a wide swath. And I don't agree with everything that's written in this book, but it's definitely doing what I appreciate, which is approaching the questions head on, approaching the problems that people have with the church, with the Bible, with families, with politics, and it's head on. It's a fascinating book. The middle book is called Paul Among the People, and I just read this yesterday, and I was so excited about it, because it's written by a Quaker woman theologian who teaches out of Yale, so not like the bastion of, you know, super uber conservative theology, but nevertheless, she basically became converted to the Apostle Paul by actually becoming an expert in first century Greek and Roman thought. And so she was a translator of the Aeneid and the Iliad and the Aeschylus and all these great poems, and began to realize that the world that the Apostle Paul was writing and what he was saying to that world was something so radical and amazing that it simply had to be talked about. So she wrote this book. I'm going to talk about it more later. And finally, The Triumph of Christianity. If you've been to any of my classes, you know this is one of my favorite books, particularly because it's very accessible. I'm not a sociologist, and this is a guy who's writing as a sociologist to people like me. So I appreciate that. But it's basically the study of how Jesus and the message about Jesus changed the world. And it's just factual, because no matter what, how people want to explain it, the reality is that Christianity began with one person and then spread to 12 and then spread to 5 billion or whatever the number finally will be. And so he was fascinated simply by that fact alone, not necessarily simply as a theologian. Anyway, I highly recommend these. But let's go to why we're here. My task was to deal with the question why people are quote-unquote spiritual but not religious. And it just so happened this week the Courier Journal helped me out because they had a editorial on Wednesday. I don't take the paper because it's like basically just a bunch of advertisements with like some syndicated columns in it, but it's a that's no offense if anyone's an editor or something here, but it's happening to all newspapers, you know. I mean, it's like they have one page with like one staff writer and then everyone else is syndicated. So their editorial this week said, and you can read it if you want, but it's nothing you haven't heard. It says, more young people in the United States are becoming disenchanted with organized religion, and perhaps it's not surprising. You know, this is leading the hook it gets you. And then it goes on to talk about one-fifth of Americans and one-third of adults under 30 do not identify with any religious denomination, according to a 2012 study by the Pew Research Center's Forum on Religion and Public Life. Now, we'll go one more. This is the rest of the thing. The nuns also, quote, think that religious organizations are too concerned with money and power, too focused on rules, and too involved with politics, the Pew study found. Such individuals are not necessarily atheists, though some are, the study found. Many consider themselves spiritual or believe in God, but don't align with any particular religious denomination, including some highly skeptical young adults. And this is the final statement. Religion serves an important role in knitting together communities. It provides solace in times of stress and grief. Churches play a vital role in social services. Just consider what Louisville would be like without its community ministry association, supported by a network of local churches. Yet, it appears some religious leaders have overreached in trying to force beliefs into government and public policy, and youths are beginning to reject that message. Churches need to rethink the mission and the message, they say. Now, there's so much to be said about this, and I'm going to return at the end to the very specific claims that they're making here, but I think there are a couple of issues going on right now. One is that in the history of the world, if you want to imbue your argument with a specific gravitas, all you have to do is start talking about children and youth. And so there's a certain amount of like, you know, where are the children? Let's do it for the kids. I mean, in the name of the children, you know, I could get you all to, you know, give me tons of money. I mean, whatever the case may be. And so there's a certain sense in which when the church talks about the youth, you know, there's this sense of added urgency, but it's no more urgent than it is for the old or the infirm or the next generation, because what we're talking about are just simply the fact that fewer people are going to church, period, and that there is a growing generation of young people, which you know, I keep saying, you know, when I went to seminary, Liza and I were both there, and the average age at our seminary was 43. And at that time, I was 25 and she was 23, and this was included in the average age. So you can imagine our class was, it was like, you know, people were much older than we were. And this was in seminary. And so literally from the beginning of my ministry, particularly in the Episcopal Church, I have been considered to be part of this elusive young demographic. Now, I've just turned 35, so I'm out of the, like, final, you know, it's like 25 to 34. And then something happens at 35 where you're no longer part of the young group. So I started taking men's over 40 multivitamins. Which is true, actually, because I was like, what's the difference, really? If there are any doctors here who think that's a bad thing, come talk to me later. But as far as I can tell, it's nothing bad about it. But the point of that is that, you know, it's funny. I have to laugh because there are a lot of people who are running around, you know, like the sky is falling, about youth not coming to church, and I'm sitting there literally for the past 15 years saying, well, you're talking to me, you're talking to one. Like, you know, I go to church. There are people that I know go to church. There are people going to church. Now, so this is why the two things, that there are many youth going to church. They just aren't coming to, by and large, the mainline churches of which we are part, meaning the old historic Protestant churches. And there are many reasons for that. But, you know, if you go down the street to, like, Sojourn Church or Southeast or, you know, Rock and Roll Church somewhere, like, there are tons of young people going to church. And to be fair, there are young people all over the world going to church. I mean, half of the African immigrants that we served in Vienna, Austria, were under 30, you know, who had 17 kids, and they were all coming to church, too. And so the point, there's something very specific happening in our demographic and in our world, because there does seem to be fewer people going to church. And this is what the research is showing, is that in America, in particular, we are seeing fewer young people confessing, or not confessing, but at least admitting to being involved in organized religion. But they are saying that they are spiritual but not religious. So we're going to come back to this, but I just wanted to say that I'm very sympathetic, obviously, and I was hired to be a part of helping the young people come to. I keep laughing when I call myself a young person because I don't feel that young. But the reality, what I'd like to say is that this is not a problem that is simply besetting young people. That it is across the board, and that many of your friends, perhaps some of you, are quote unquote the old people who go to church, who simply go because that's where your friends go. Or maybe because you really can't think of going anywhere else on Sunday, and you like going to brunch, and there's a rhythm, and it reminds you of your ex-wife or your deceased parents or whatever the case is. But you really, at the end of the day, given the option, if you could rewind 30 years and do something else on Sunday, maybe you would have. And it's okay. Like, I'm here for you. We're going to work through that. Don't be afraid. But my point is that if more people were honest, I think that there would be a higher number than this among over 30-year-olds than they have. And again, this is because Christianity is not something you're born into. It's not something that makes sense. It's not something that is a clearly divined truth from nature. It's a revealed religion that people are converted to. And there are many people that are involved in it who aren't converted. And sometimes that's okay, too, because many times, like, the disciples themselves lived and worked with Jesus for 3 years until they were converted. So some of you have been going to church for 30 years and aren't converted yet. It's okay. But just keep coming, because the promise of God is that he is the one who will ultimately open eyes, unstop ears, give sight to the blind, make the lame walk. And some of you are still blind. And many ministers are still blind. But, you know, then they go to Alpha, or they get sick, or something happens to them. I mean, this happens all the time. They're like, well, I was a preacher for 20 years, and then I actually believed it one day. And, well, you know, my ministry took off. I'm like, no joke. How about that? This happens. You'd be surprised. I mean, there's a good friend of mine, and there's one church in New York that would be considered sort of traditionally, and the Episcopal Church, like, traditionally, kind of like, it's in touch with its low church Protestant roots, evangelical roots, and there's one of them. And the minister was kind of, you know, a normal guy who ministered for 25 years, and then he had a health scare, and like that combined with, lo and behold, the message of the gospel turned him into sort of like a Baptist in an Episcopal gear, you know. And so, and this congregation didn't really know what to do with it, but it's still there, and it's a wonderful thing. So we can pray for your ministers that will all continue to be converted. I mean, here's what happens, is that the idea in this, there's a lot of history behind this, has a lot to do with post-Enlightenment thinking, and the idea that conversion is this one-off experience where you know, it happened, that's it, and then something changes forever. I mean, there's a truth in that, because obviously it's like getting married, you know? I mean, this is why the Apostle Paul uses the analogy of becoming a Christian along with marriage, because yes, there is a day you got married. But to say that that settles it with respect to the question, well, that's ridiculous, because the rest of your life is spent wrestling with what that means, how that affects you, whether it affects you in good or bad ways, and that's what the Christian life is like. That's why the message doesn't change, because the people continue to change. You know, you get older, your parents begin to get sick, your children grow up, your jobs change, and so you change, but the message doesn't. But that, and so what that means is that there's a constant engagement with the gospel message and a constant sense of being converted. So, you know, these Greek tenses, the aorist tense, is something that, like when we say Christ our Passover is sacrificed, well, it also could be translated has been, is, will be, because it means that something happened in the past has continuing relevance for the present. And that's what it means to say that I've become a Christian. It means that I once was something else, because you can't be born a Christian. But when that dawning realization came that I became a Christian, well, then that event in the past has continuing significance for the rest of my life. And so that's what we're, I think what the all I'm trying to say is that when the alarms go up, you know, we can take great comfort in the church history, in the witness of the saints, in all of the churches and all of their fractured beauty, in that the that it has been much worse. More people became Christian in the 20th century than all other centuries combined. I mean, it's partly because there were more people on the earth, but also because with technology and the missionary movement, more people were getting out there and professing and proclaiming Christ to the world. So what's happening, that's not to minimize what's happening here, and believe me, I'm very sympathetic. I mean, I want to have a job in 10 years, you know, and like I want people my age to come to church, and I want to have a relationship and a life together that the Lord promises that the saints together will have. And so I'm very sympathetic to that. So here we go. What's going on? It's funny. I just put these in because this guy on the left, Bishop Spong, who's, I'd say bishop with a quote, he wrote a book called Why Christianity Must Change or Die. And the irony is Liza and I spent a summer as a seminarian in his diocese where under his direction, there had been 12 churches in Jersey City when he took office. And then there was only one church that still had enough money to have a full-time rector by the time he left. So his changes have actually killed Christianity. So just the irony of the book title. And so we have, here are the membership losses in the mainline churches. ELCA is the Evangelical Lutheran Church, TEC is the Episcopal Church, the PCUSA is the Presbyterian USA, and the United Church of Christ. This is just to give you a heads up that the church that we're involved in is not alone in the mainline churches. Again, this is what we call the old historic Protestant churches are in precipitous decline. I mean, I don't know the exact figures, but there's something like in the last 20 years, 30% of the church, of the Episcopal Church, has declined. I mean, there are many, many factors, but it's just, it is what it is. It's a statement of fact that there are more Muslims in America than all mainline Protestants worshiping. I mean, things like this. You can't really believe it, but there it is. But on the other hand, this is what was interesting. Robin showed this a couple of weeks ago. And look at this. The nominals, the nuns, are becoming the nuns. As the cultural values of identifying as Christian decreases, Christianity is no longer the first choice of many seeking spiritual meaning, but it also means more vibrant congregations. Now, what's happening is that because you can join the Rotary Club as opposed to the Episcopal Church and have the same benefits, people are deciding that they don't really want to deal with the Episcopal Church or whatever church it may be and just join the Rotary Club. And so this may not have been the case 50 years ago. You know, people might have looked at you a little strange if you had said, you know, where do you go to church? And they're like, well, I don't go to church because I'm an atheist. They've been like, well, you're no longer going to be doing business with us, sir. And they're like, oh, did I say atheist? I meant Arminian. That's what I meant. And they're like, well, that also doesn't help. But no, the point is that what's happening is that the cultural values that the benefit to being a Christian is becoming it's sort of nominal at best. I mean, I don't know about you, but it's actually, particularly being a minister, it's not really like a great social job to have. You know, to go to a dinner party, like, great, we're going to invite the religious zealot once again, you know, to don't get him started about anything important because he's going to talk about Jesus again, you know. And so we go to weddings. You know, I go to weddings and I always get put with if they know me, then it's fine. They're like, well, just, you know, that's another issue. But if they don't, they're like, we're going to put him with, you know, my aunt who's a witch who needs to get talked to, you know, like literally a witch. or or are they going to put him with the table of like other religious weirdos, you know, who's like. And so it really, I feel, pray for Liza, like this is what she got signed up into. But there you go. So all that being said, something is going on. Something is going on, and it's actually very uncomfortable in a sense for Christians, because what's happening is that people who are beginning, who really believe, or people who don't believe are being called or distancing themselves from the faith. And so what's left are people who sort of believe are being forced to actually ask themselves, do I really? And that's a very uncomfortable position for people because, you know, the like I said in the beginning, the husbands and wives who have this perennial fight about going to church before, you know, on Sunday mornings, well now, you know, there's no additional ballast in either one of their arguments about like, well, that's just what you do, or that's what, you know, if you don't go, your boss is going to be there and he's going to think you became a weirdo, or like, you know, our friends are there. Like fewer and fewer things like that are happening, so that the real question is being begged, which is, do you actually believe in Jesus? Are you a Christian? And if you are, then you go to church. But if you aren't, or you're sort of nominal about it, well then what's happening is that fewer and fewer of those people are going. And so it's sort of like, this is what the argument is that the congregations, this makes sense, the congregations where people are continuing to go have kind of gone through all of these reasons not to and still said, well, yes, I do believe. I know it's hard to get here, and I know that, you know, my kids are going to have to miss lacrosse practice, and I know that, you know, my coworkers think that's kind of weird, and I know that there are all these reasons why I shouldn't or couldn't go, but none of them trump the fact that I want to. And so they're going. And so you can imagine, when you get a group of people together like that, well, those churches are pretty spectacular, because you have a bunch of people who aren't sitting there saying, oh, I don't know, I kind of believe it, and I hope, when's this going to end, and I hope it doesn't run into the game. They're like, this is the meaning of my life is being recentered here. This is where my entire family's nucleus is surrounded. This is what I want my children to look like. This is what I want my life to look like. This is where I want to be buried, because it's in this faith is where I have found my hope. And so those churches are exploding. And so there are not many in the mainline churches left. But our church, of course, you know, look around you. I mean, we have a great, big, glorious church. So it speaks to the type faith that is being nurtured, fed, and maintained here. I mean, remember, Jude, the apostle, who was also martyred, writes to his in his letter about the faith once delivered to the saints. I mean, there's a lot to be said about this, but one could argue that wherever the faith, as it was delivered to the apostles, is being faithfully perpetuated, there you find Christians. Because, as it were, the seeds of faith have been faithfully planted, and where the seeds are planted, the Lord increases. In many mainline churches, this faith is not being planted, so it makes perfect sense that there are no growing seeds. This is, it just is clear as day, because what has happened to spiritual but not religious is that people, there are two different types of spiritual thinking in the world, and one is that spiritualism emanates from within human beings. If you've heard my sermon, you're going to hear there's a lot of overlap here, but there you go. And the other one is that it's external to you. Now, what happened during the Enlightenment, and this is Kant on the left, and keep calm, understand epistemology. Epistemology is just a big word, which means how do we know anything at all? Like, it's sort of the science of thought itself, and it's a fascinating thing. But what he says is that external contingent revelation is the, quote, salto mortale, the death leap of human reason. And what he means by that, in his famous Religion Within the Limits of Reason Alone, is that if there actually is something in life that's important, one, and two, that is dependent upon external revelation, well then that throws all human reasoning out the window. What he means by that, and he's specifically with Christianity with regards to faith, is that if faith is something that has to come from without, outside of you, if it's not something that can be, if belief in God cannot be derived from nature or derived from the existence of numbers or like gravity, like some Masons think, you know, or something, if God cannot be derived from within nature, then that means that there's something that we can't figure out, and what's the point in thinking at all? I mean, this is actually where he thought. So where he put the existence of God was in the law that emanates from within. And so he said that is, it's a fascinating thing, and I recommend, I don't know if you should read it or not, but just trust me, it's long. But it's he puts the proof of God in the existence of the moral law. And so he says that's how we know that God exists. So it's not something outside of us. It's not the fact that for instance, Jesus came back from the dead, or that miracles exist, or that there's something that we need to be taught. It's something that we need to realize is within ourselves. So the problem with this, of course, disregarding the fact that it goes against the Christian tenets, as they have been passed down to us, is that what does it begin to say about what is most important to God? If God is determined and evoked by the existence of the moral law in the heart, well, then what does that begin to say about what God considers to be most important in life? The moral law. And so when you have this law that is supposedly within yourself, that is the proof of the existence of God, then you begin to lose the specific points of revelation that are in Jesus in particular, and begin to have a religion that is based upon following the moral law, which of course is not dependent upon any specific revelation of God. So what happened is that when God, Kant wasn't trying to do this, I don't think. He was a son of a Lutheran pastor. He grew up in Germany. But nevertheless, this is where his ideas led him. It's a little bit like Darwin. Darwin, I think, he didn't intend his teaching to get in the hands of what's his name? Not Aldous Huxley. Is the other Darwin's bull? What was his name? Richard Huxley? Anyway, it wasn't Aldous. Thomas Huxley took Darwin's writings and was like, in this, we can bring down the Pope. That's basically his whole thought, and he did. So anyway, or he tried to. The point of this is that, let me get back. So what happened? When God can be accessed inside of oneself, then the need for external discussion about God has been obviated. What that means is that good people begin to be connected to God, this irrespective of how this God is understood. This is what the result of it was. So that we can have people who begin to, be spiritual, meaning moral, but not religious. This is what happens. And so you begin to have people who aren't involved in religious, specific churches at all, begin to judge those churches based upon their understanding of God. Do you see how this works? So you probably have friends who look at the church and say, the church is immoral. Essentially that's what they're saying. The church is backwards. The church is, your religion, revealed religion, is wrong. And based upon what? Well, based upon God. Well, who is God? Well, God is the law. Well, says who? Well, it's within me. This is what happens. And Feuerbach saw this. Ludwig Feuerbach, writing shortly after, he said, this is what's happening, is that the true sense of theology is actually just anthropology, meaning that people project onto heaven a God who looks like them, who is really okay with their particular besetting problems, but is okay with that. Like, he doesn't really mind that you drink a little too much. He doesn't mind that you cuss every now and then. This is the God that but he does really get upset with whatever it is that you think you're doing well, that you are doing that other people aren't doing. He gets really upset with tax cheats. He gets really upset with those people that vote Democrat or Republican. He gets really upset with people that speed, but he doesn't really get upset with people who, every now and then, do whatever it is that you do, bet on your golf game. That God's fine. You see what happens is that people develop a sense of God based upon what they already think they know about who God is. Irrespective of what God, the religious claims of the world, there are, not surprising, many claims to who God is and what he's like, and or she is like, or they are like. The world is full of these claims, and people nevertheless feel that it is something that they can simply derive from meditation within themselves. Now, what's happened in Christianity is that the true statement made by the New Testament that God is love, when that is connected, remember, to the external specific revelation of how God is love, which is through the cross and death and resurrection of Christ, when that is taken away and one begins to meditate on God as love, well, you know what? Remember what Jesus said love is. The two great commandments, love your God, love your neighbor. Love is the law. So God, when disconnected from external revelation, becomes the internal law, then all that begins to turn into is that love, i.e. the law, is God. And think about your friends, or think about yourself, or think about people you talk to who are quote-unquote spiritual but not religious. They judge and condemn the actions of the church, of other people, of governments, of themselves, based upon what? On the law of love. They say, I can do this, I can't do that, you should do that, you shouldn't do that, all because of love. But the problem is, when it's disconnected from an external referent, well, what is love? Well, love then begins to be that thing that drives one person, but it oftentimes drives one person, well, to another person for a brief amount of time and then away from them. Like, it basically, competing laws, i.e. God's, can only be regulated by who? Lawyers. That's where the world is. When God doesn't exist as a definitive statement about who love is, which is Jesus, remember, love, God is love, is another way of saying Jesus died for you. When that is disconnected, then God becomes the law, which is love, which in the world of competing loves can only be regulated by lawyers. And that's where we live today. So I love you, you love me. Well, you know, how does that love look? Well, let's hope it looks similarly, because then we'll get together. But when we decide that this love that we both still have is no longer compatible, well, then we have to have our loves regulated by a third party who is also in the process of helping us define what love is. And so this is where we live today. I mean, this is the perpetuation of it. And so what is happening? This is Reinhold Niebuhr, who wrote this back in 1937. Is it in Christianity when this happens? We have a God without wrath who brought men without sin into a kingdom without judgment through the ministrations of a Christ without a cross. Because what has happened is that all of the trappings of Christianity, all of the sort of supposedly beneficial things that come from it, have been divested of any true meaning when it is disconnected from the event of specific revelation. And so what happens is that Christianity actually becomes a crutch, or not a crutch, but a hindrance towards people's actual spiritual lives when it's understood this way. And so you'll find people who say, I don't go to church because it's stuffy and I'm a spiritual person. You know, I commune with nature or something like this. You know, they don't go to the very place where spirituality is ensconced because they're spiritual people. I mean, it's fascinating what's happening. I'm not alone in this. I mean, the problem with this is that, I'm going to come back to that one. I love this, spiritual, not religious. Never heard of, you know, these. So what's taking place? I'm hurrying here. I really wanted questions, but there's a lot of information here. What has happened? Oh, shoot. Can I have a, I spilled that. I said shoot. That's amazing. I'm a very sanctified person. Thank you. So anyway, what's happening? Secularization. Now I don't get this on my own. This is a great book. I highly recommend it. It's written in like 70 languages, like the Pope is wont to do. But it's a dialogue between the Pope and a German philosopher named Jürgen Habermas. It's basically what's happening. Secularization is like a car. The past 300 years in the West is like a car that has had the engine taken out of it, but it was going really fast. And so somehow the engine got out when it was still moving. Because when the engine has been understood and is clearly the Christian faith, the Judeo-Christian worldview, the idea that there are inalienable human rights, the idea that children should be protected, the idea that men and women, you know, are related in certain ways. All of these things that are the foundation and bedrock of Western society. I mean, you know, the legal system based upon the idea of ultimate justice. Well, when that engine was removed, then secularization was allowed to continue to capitalize on a lot of these ideas, even though they stopped believing in God. So its analogy is that the engine had been removed. And so what's happening now, though, is that in the postmodern, whatever they want to call it, world, where people are beginning to say, you know what, I don't even think, what are inalienable rights? There is no God. There's nothing true about human nature or human dignity. I mean, maybe you think there is, but I don't think it is. So now the car is beginning to slow. And what you see happening, particularly in Europe, and it's just a matter of time before it happens here, is that in the absence of God and in the absence of a reason why the world is created, well, then human life, human dignity, and human existence becomes the caprice at the whims of a capricious 51% majority. Now, Germans in particular are very terrified of this happening because 51% of people brought the Third Reich into power in a democratically elected way. And so what's happening is Jürgen Moltmann is starting to say, hey, Pope, you know, I don't believe in any of this, but like it does seem like the engine is still running in your car. Can you help us? And there's a fascinating discussion taking place because what's happening is so funny to me that people talk this way because, you know, the progressive people in the world, right? You know, and this is nothing against tattoos, but I always use the idea of tattoos. You know, people who are like, I'm so progressive, I'm getting a tattoo. I'm like, well, you know, that's fine, great, but just don't do it on your neck, you know, usually. But, you know, the earliest cave drawings we have of human beings in existence, you know what their body was covered with? That's right, tattoos. You know, so you're sitting there saying, well, the progression of the world has brought us full circle back to the regression of humanity. And that happens in all sorts of things, like the people that talk about the progress that we're making is actually a regressive march back to paganism. Now, when I say paganism, what I mean is, again, remember, there are two types of religion, one that's outside of you and one that emanates from within. Well, pagans believe that since we are all part of God, God is nature and the world and the spirit, well, then we must be able to connect with God, both within ourselves and within the created world. And so that is how paganism is distinct from the Christian. The Jews, first of all, were the ones who were like, no, God created the world. The world didn't emanate from him. In the beginning, there was nothing. God, ex nihilo, out of nothing, created the world. And the pagans were like, say what? I don't think so. They're like, it's always existed, and it's on a cycle, and it's basically Disney, you know, circle of life. That's if you want to know what paganism is, go watch, don't let your kids watch The Lion King, but that's it, because that is perpetuating paganism in a very benign way. But the regression of human society is a result of the car that was moving along with the engine of the Judeo-Christian worldview. When its engine was removed, it is slowing. And if you want to picture it going up a hill, what we are involved with is it's beginning to roll backwards. So you'll find your friends who are otherwise enlightened, educated people. I mean, I don't know about your friends, none of my friends, your friends, who will begin to say things about the universe, or karma, or actually believe in astrology, or perhaps say things about how, you know, the spirit of the universe will teach them this, or that they had this feeling of God with them and when they were at a yoga class, or something like this. This is all, would be all very recognizable to first century pagans. The same people that Jesus came into the world to preach to, and then the Apostle Paul's message radically changed. Now, Leslie Newbegin, who I highly recommend this book, was a missionary bishop to India. Now, India, of course, is full of, you know, tons of different type of religious things, many gods, and he was converting people and talking to them about Christianity. And he said this, that the myth of the secular society, in the 25 since Mumby wrote his book, which is called The Idea of the Secular Society, we have learned something about the secular society. Whoops, sorry. We have learned, I think, that what has come into being is not a secular society, but a pagan society. Not a society devoid of public images, but a society which worships gods which are not God. But the myth of a secular society remains. And so what's funny about this is that what are things, they worship things that are not gods. Well, if you are biblical literate at all, which is no one anymore, but if you are, you would hear echoes of that from the Apostle Paul in Romans, where writing to pagan people in a pagan world among different claims about how God can be accessed within, he diagnoses the world as God has given them up to their own desires and they have exchanged the truth of God, which is clearly written in the heavens, for a lie and began worshiping things that by their very nature are not gods, i.e. birds, reptiles, animals, and themselves. And so now what we have is people will say, yes, well, you know, we don't worship a golden calf. We don't worship a big, you know, lizard that's been bronzed. But, you know, just think about all the people that are worshiped, beginning with yourself. Think about all of the temples to human beauty. Think about the hospitals that know no end to the hope that somehow the human being finally will be like God, which again is the echo back to Genesis, because the primal concern of human nature was that they would not die and that they would be like God. And to the end that we could ever have those things, the thing that holds out the promise of those two great hopes is what we worship. And people have stopped believing that Jesus is the one who gives those eternal life and have looked to other things. And so this is what's taking place. Now, I'm finishing. There's so much going on. Back to these three books. This is a nutshell. This is a thumbnail sketch of these. But here's how I would respond to the Courier Journal. So religion serves an important role in knitting together communities that provide solace in times of stress and grief. I mean, that's like saying, the question, of course, is always, when people try to define the benefit of something based upon its sociological manifestation as opposed to the content it's talking about. I mean, what is this religion? I mean, the religion that we all develop here today where we think that the Ohio River is divine and we all go down there and worship it and like we would have a great picnic. I mean, that's essentially what they're saying, you know. Whereas I want to say that the rise of Christianity, on the other hand, has a wonderful passage in the very beginning, where there was a great and terrible plague that beset the Jerusalem in 134 AD or so, which is about 100 years after Jesus was alive. And there's the account of a local Roman official who describes the melee that ensued, particularly around the temples to, you know, the various gods and goddesses that were there. And he says that our gods have failed us. People are rioting and looting and going crazy, like in London a couple of years ago. You know, this is what's happening. Like, all of the CVSs are being looted, and we can't do anything about it. Our gods have failed us. We also have a contemporaneously written letter from the bishop who was over the people there in Jerusalem at the time, and his letter to them was, "My children, take heart, be calm. Know that these are the trials and tribulations that the Lord has promised us beforehand, and that even though some of us may die, we will be with him in eternity." And you know what happened? The pagans fled the city. The Christians remained. And it turned out that it was the type of plague where if you had clean water, you wouldn't necessarily die. And so many people became converted because when a Christian stood there and said, "I'm not afraid to die, would you like some of my clean water?" And you lived, that was a pretty powerful witness to the truth of their lives. And so don't tell me about the important role in knitting together communities, because there are many communities that should not be knit together and should be, in fact, you know, pushed apart, but Christians are not one of them. So, secondly, we're almost done. The Apostle Paul, you have to read this, because the world, there's so much to be said about this, but when God is synonymous with your internal desires, unchecked and unquestioned, well, then there are many varied and sundry ways that humans can be related to each other, to animals, to their governments, to any number of permutations. This was a world that the Apostle Paul inhabited, where you had slaves and mistresses and wives and concubines, and it was the family structure was fluid with respect to how it actually worked. It was only rigid with respect to what the legal situation of what a marriage constituted was. Now, if any women in here are okay with that, you know, well, my husband doesn't ever actually stay with me or has all sorts of different and various affairs, but technically we are married, you know, like smiling with a tear coming down. I mean, that's the world that the Apostle Paul came into, and he radically upended it because he said, God has created you for a reason, differentiated you for a purpose, and has given you a plan for how you will be related. And so if you don't, people can disagree with that, as they always have, but the Christian church has always been very interested in how human beings are related to each other because they believe that God has given us a plan, a rule, and a reason why. Not because they're moralistic, pietistic nuns smacking everyone around, but because they believe that human flourishing exists when people are properly ordered together in the ways that God has created them to be. Finally, churches need to rethink the mission and the message. That's not true. To the extent that they need to change it. But too few churches are actually preaching the mission and the message that as was given to us. And so our job and goal here, and Robin and Debbie with Tess and Robin, Raleigh and everyone, that's what we're doing. That's what we're going to continue to do. And it's something that I hope will continue to keep you coming back, at the very least, to continue to walk along this great journey of conversion as we seek to live and serve the Lord. Thanks be to God. Amen.